This episode of Continuing Mission is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Continuing Mission, our look at the ways in which fans are keeping Star Trek alive. I'm your host, Christopher Jones, and the primary focus of this show is on the fan series, or as I prefer to call them, independent productions, that tell new stories set in the Star Trek universe. We know a great deal about the 23rd and 24th centuries, but our exploration of the 22nd was unfortunately cut short. The cancellation of Enterprise not only left behind a number of loose threads from the series, but also key moments in Star Trek history that a prequel really should have explored. Almost 10 years after Enterprise left television, the feature-length film Star Trek Horizon aims to close one of those gaps by telling the story of the famous Earth-Romulan War. Made by fans in love with Star Trek and set during the Enterprise time period, Horizon centers on the Coalition of Planets, a young alliance of worlds led by Earth that is at war with the Romulan Empire. Desperate for a chance to gain the upper hand, the Coalition forms an alliance with Tamar, a Romulan deserter, in the hopes that she can provide valuable intelligence on her former masters. Now, it sounds very interesting, and to learn more about this story and how the film is being put together, I'm joined today by writer, director, and executive producer Tommy Kraft and actor Mark Bowers, who plays Commander Jackson Gates, first officer of the NX-04 Discovery. Hello, Tommy and Mark. Thanks so much for joining me today on Continuing Mission to talk about Horizon. I didn't know much about this project before I started talking to you guys, and I'm really excited about it because I am a big Enterprise fan.
Well, hey, no problem. Big Enterprise fan here, too, so it's really nice to get a chance to talk to you.
And Mark, how about you? Were you an Enterprise fan also before you signed on to this project?
Well, I admittedly am not a huge... Not that I'm not a fan. I guess I never gave it enough of a chance to become a fan of. I knew of the series, and of course, who doesn't know about Star Trek? But I think in looking into more of it since I signed on to do this, I definitely have the potential to become a huge fan of this series. So,
excellent. Well, before we get into the whole discussion here, tell me a little bit about your creative backgrounds and, of course, what brought you in here. So, Tommy, you're the writer and executive producer of Horizon.
Yeah, and director and costumer and CGI guy and composer.
And maybe composer as well. Am I right about that?
Yeah, there's that one too. let's see, there's... you mentioned writer, right? I think there's that one.
I think so.
Yeah. I'm sure there's some other ones. You know, I've gone through this every time I've made a movie because I usually do so much of it myself, and I always hate crediting myself at the end of the movie, because it just looks so, you know, narcissistic to have this like huge long thing with Tommy Kraft. So I usually just go a film by Tommy Kraft, and then I don't have to worry about
it. Okay. You're not doing like a Tommy Kraft joint?
No, not usually.
Well, how about you, Mark?
Well, I have lightly dabbled in writing and lightly more so even dabbled in directing and never composed anything. I guess I prefer to just stick to the acting and do some voiceover things here in Michigan. And that's sort of the extent of my creative endeavors in film and in the recorded media.
Excellent. What kind of voiceovers do you do?
All different types, actually. I've done a few commercials. I've done a few industrial voiceovers where there needs to be sort of a voice narrating, I guess, in the background without without me being on camera, per se. And I've done, I did an audio book, and I've done, I played a character in a children's book.
Oh, very cool. Well, let's talk about the actual Horizon Project a little bit, and what was the genesis of this, because as I told you guys, well, at the beginning here, and also as we were talking before the show, I'm a big fan of Enterprise, which seems to be sort of, I don't know, maybe it makes me an outlier a little bit amongst the Star Trek fan base, although I think that's coming around a little bit in recent years. There seems to be a growing interest in Enterprise, but it's definitely the most polarizing chapter in the Star Trek saga, and fans seem to either love it or they hate it, or with the majority of fans, they just never give it a fair chance. It's just there, and maybe they watched the first few episodes and then they kind of tuned out. So Tommy, why did you decide to pick Enterprise specifically as the time period for the setting of this film?
Well, I've always been a big Trekkie and sci-fi fan in general, and I kind of fell out of Star Trek up until about a year and a half, 2 years ago. It's not to say I wasn't interested, but I wasn't watching it all the time. And then I hit a really rough patch, personally. And when I was watching, I decided to go back and rewatch Enterprise, because when you go through something like depression, it's, you know, oftentimes you lose energy to do absolutely anything. And so I got into one of those phases where I was just watching a lot of TV shows, in between still trying to finish up my college degree and everything like that. And so I started rewatching Enterprise, and the story of the show and the way Captain Archer was portrayed by Scott Bakula and the sort of explorer's heart, in the show really kind of, I latched onto that this time, and I realized, and of course, only being 22 the last time I watched it, I was, you know, a young teen, and there were a lot of things that I was able to pick up on this time around that I didn't back when it was more about cool space fights and everything. And right. So this story, this evolving story of Enterprise and the first crew really spoke to me in the changes and events going on in my life at the time. And it gave me a passion for this show that I didn't have with the other Star Treks, which I certainly loved, but not necessarily enough to devote, you know, a couple of years of my life to doing full-time a movie based on it and to do it professionally. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's the kind of project that I want to be a really great professional project. But it has a lot of personal meaning to it there as well.
Yeah, I find the character interactions in Enterprise to be, and like you, as I get older and I pay a little more attention to those character interactions, compared to most of Star Trek, outside of Deep Space Nine, of course, I think Enterprise did a really nice job with the character interactions. Of course, they didn't give all their characters enough to do all the time, but when they did, it was quite nice.
There was a certain humanity there to that show, you know, that you didn't necessarily get or were able to relate to in the other shows. And that's certainly there, I mean, with the original series and TNG and DS9. I do like Voyager, too. I'm just going to throw that out there. Some people will get on you for that. But it goes back to the explorer's heart thing, that it's like, the way these people were portrayed as the first ones out there, they did such a good job, both from a writing perspective and an acting perspective, making those interactions come to life. And, you know, they could have focused more on Hoshi and Travis. They probably would have as the show if they'd gotten more time. But, you know, that's part of the problem, too, of getting cut so short.
Definitely. So Mark, when you saw the script for this, how did you come to be involved in the project? I mean, did you know Tommy prior to this? Did you see a script and you saw maybe some of the character interactions that we're talking about that attracted you to it?
Well, I had worked with Tommy on a few short films, actually, for about a year and a half prior to this coming along. And I had Tommy work with me on a webisode, little project that I did, which is what I referred to earlier when I said that I had dabbled very lightly in directing and writing. And actually, Tommy approached me. He texted me, I think a November or an October evening, and a text came through, and he asked if I would be interested in being part of his Star Trek film and if I would be willing to play the first officer. And I said yes because I knew it was going to be good. You know, I knew that, you know, it would be nothing less than stellar if it came from Tommy Kraft. So, and then once I read the script and got together with Tommy and other potential cast members at that point and went through the script, I knew that it was going to be great and that I had to have the part that he wanted me to have. So it really was a no-brainer. And I, you know, I can never say that I don't trust Tommy's instinct. I definitely do. And while in the beginning I thought, I don't know if I really see myself in this character, I've come to realize that that he knows exactly what he's doing, and I see more of myself in this character than I will ever admit to him.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. If you lived in the 22nd century, do you think you would be an explorer? Would you go out there on a ship like this and explore?
I would. Was that for Mark or was that for me? I know I would. I look up at the stars every night and I wish I could go out there. That's like one of my biggest dreams.
What about you, Mark?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, I've always been fascinated by just by things that are beyond what we can see, even. And just, you know, the fact that the stars are so minute to us, but even within each star there is, you know, there's this great vast unknown, you know. So it's always fascinated me, for sure.
You just hope you won't be in the middle of a war while you're doing that exploration of other star systems, right?
Absolutely, right.
That'd be my luck. I'd get out there and I'd find myself like the first. I'd probably be the one to like accidentally start the war or something. You know, I'd fly my ship over the wrong planet and they'd attach a mine, you know, to the hull of my ship and try to blow me up. And then I'd have to go out there and, of course, defuse the mine. And then I'd get stuck in the leg with, you know, with the mine thing. And then
sounds like your name might actually be Reed.
Well, that's classified Section 31. So,
all right.
If you don't know, Mark, that's I was quoting the plot of one of the Enterprise episodes. So you're not totally lost.
Okay. No, it doesn't take much, but that definitely did it. So it's, thank you for clarifying. I appreciate that.
No problem.
Let me ask you, Tommy, one more thing about Enterprise while we're talking about why you chose this time period. And we talked a lot about the humanity here, and one thing that I love about the series is that it does feel closer to us. I love the NX-01 because it feels like a ship that we would actually build.
Oh, yeah.
The design aesthetic and all of it is like something we would build, as opposed to the ships of the 24th century, which really are still very futuristic and like little cities in space,
yeah,
you know, to us now. At the same time, I think that Enterprise, somewhat because of studio wishes, maybe more so than what Brandon and Rick wanted to do with the story, moved quickly back into the familiar,
yeah,
Star Trek territory and moved a little bit more away from what we could relate to. What did you think about that yourself and how they balanced that?
Well, I think it's really interesting when I've heard them talk about how they originally wanted to set the show on Earth. And the first season would be completely following the construction of the Enterprise. That would have been a really cool take, too, and I would have actually loved to see that. That's not to say that I would rather that instead of what they did do. But I think that the way, what they had to deal with the studios and with having to keep that familiarity, they did a very good job of making the crew to be, they did a good job of making the crew out to be newbies, essentially, at mm-hmm. this whole space exploration thing. I was listening to your podcast about Dead Stop, and
oh, yeah.
you were talking about how Archer would just go up to aliens and introduce himself, and he's like, hey, this is where we're from, you know?
Here's
and,
a picture of Earth.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's how you get there.
Yeah. And, of course, at the time, Earth didn't have, you know, a squat for any defenses or anything either right. that we know of. And so I think this, and then, of course, you have the episode where they lost the communicator mm-hmm. on that planet. And it's stuff like that that they were able to bring that new sense of first-time explorers and doing this, the first ones out there, to this old idea of, you know, story of the week, exploring space kind of thing. It's actually, especially season 3, was a lot more of what I had hoped that Voyager really? Could okay. have been.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, this whole idea, because The Expanse was like, wow, that's really cool. There's so much weird stuff out here and creepy people. And Voyager, I thought, felt more like The Next Generation in the Delta Quadrant. And
yeah, it did. It did, which was probably not the original premise, but
right.
they fell back into that pretty quickly. Yeah. Well, I mentioned the NX-01 a moment ago, and I love that ship. And the ship in your film, Horizon, is the NX-04 mm-hmm. Discovery. And in naming the NX-04 Discovery, you're following the pattern that Michael A. Martin established in the novel Beneath the Raptor's Wing, where we actually see the NX-04
right.
for the first time. And it follows the pattern that was established there also of being named after the same sequence as space shuttles from NASA's space shuttle program. Of course, your crew is different than the crew that was in Martin's novel. Did you take much inspiration from the Romulan War novel series that Martin wrote in preparing this story?
Not really, actually, because the main reason I wanted to do the movie was to close out storylines that Enterprise didn't get a chance to. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was kind of my contribution to the show that meant a lot to me. And I didn't think I could do that the way I wanted to if I was taking too much inspiration from the books. Because, I mean, eventually, I actually haven't read the books, but I think he does eventually close out the, you know, the whole Future Guy storyline too, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. And I guess the way I saw it was, I have these ideas and I really wanted to do it my own way. Maybe that sounds narcissistic. I don't know.
No.
But also, you know, it's just, it didn't interest me that much to do an adaptation. I wanted to tell a unique story in this time period.
Yeah, definitely. And the novels are, of course, as fans love to say, the novels are not canon.
Right. And well, that's why I felt good about doing that.
Yeah. So, I mean, if it's not on screen, it's open for interpretation. And we've seen that throughout novels. I mean, even different novels will give different explanations
right.
for you know, tying up threads that we saw on the screen. And certainly films like yours can do that as well. Now, the premise, of course, the right on the top of your website, it says a war with the Romulans, desperate to gain the upper hand. So the story thread that you're closing out is the Romulan War, which is, of course, why I was talking about Beneath the Raptor's Wing
right.
there. And I'd like to talk about this from two angles. And I have a good feeling, Tommy, of maybe why you chose this, because as Star Trek fans, it's like, this is what we really wanted to see play out in Enterprise, I think, especially if we got to a sixth or seventh season. Mark, how about you? Did you grow up with the original series? Do you know the whole backstory of the famous Romulan Earth War that so many fans wanted to see on Enterprise?
I am familiar with the original series and with the Next Generation, casually, I'll say. Mm-hmm. My girlfriend is a Trekkie through and through, but she's more an original series Trekkie. Mm-hmm. Somewhat Next Generation, but because of her, I guess being enamored with everything William Shatner, she has helped guide me through the original series and some of his pursuits beyond Star Trek. I guess as an outsider looking in, I know there is a Romulan war, and I know there is, you know, I know of some factoids here and there. I didn't know how, I guess, deeply important the Romulan War was or is to the canon, mm-hmm. and really mm-hmm. what its implications are for the series as a whole. So,
mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, though, you find things like this a lot with casting. With Benedict Cumberbatch, for instance, I think said he didn't even know what a Klingon was before he got the script for Into Darkness. And
maybe. Although I've seen him in interviews when they were asking him about Khan, and he's really good at pretending like he doesn't know.
That's true. He could have been playing it up. but, I mean, you hear it a lot with these kind of movies where they have this huge fandom behind them and this huge history, especially like with the comic book movies. And you get an actor involved, and you know, the big fans are interviewing the actors. You know, how did this comic book and how did this character and his backstory inspire you? And sometimes it's kind of disappointing. It's a double-edged sword. And they say, I don't really know. But in some ways, I think that's a good thing, too, because they can then bring their own sensibilities to these characters. Right. You know, they can, I wouldn't say bogged down, but it's still, they can bring an originality to it and yet still go back and learn what is behind this that the mm-hmm. fans are so interested about.
I think that's one thing about Enterprise. And when I talk to people who are diehard Enterprise fans, I often find that they aren't necessarily Star Trek fans. They're fans of Enterprise.
Right.
And often they've never seen any other Star Trek. They like the cast. And I think the story, as we talked about earlier, is a bit more relatable because you can watch it as a show set in space, but because overall the tech, you know, they don't have the technobabble of the later time period and such. And so you can kind of watch it more as a regular TV show. And so, Mark, given your background there, one thing I was wondering was being aware of the Romulan War existence, but not knowing its place within the canon and how important it is there. What did you think about the story and the script from that perspective? Just viewing it as an actor and as a creative coming in and wanting to tell a good story.
Well, I guess I like the brilliance of really setting this story against that backdrop. Mm-hmm. I think it's the relatability of it to the whole canon, as we've talked about already. I think will resonate with people who have followed Star Trek from the first series, and for people who are just coming in and only viewing this movie as a freestanding creation. You know, mm-hmm. so I think the themes are so universal, whether you're following the whole of Star Trek or whether you're just taking this from it, that I think everybody can find something to relate to in this. So,
and it just occurred to me, Mark, also that I don't think this is I don't think that we've actually told anyone yet what role you're playing in the film.
Oh.
He's the Invisible Man.
I didn't ask you that up front.
Yeah.
Bad on me.
I don't even know what role yet, to be honest. I just got the script the other day. No.
Yeah.
I play First Officer / Science Officer Jackson Gates in this film.
Excellent. So Tommy, let's pick up the script angle here. And now that we've heard from Mark, you know, kind of approaching it without the deep canon and Star Trek lore there. Now, you personally writing it, you decided, you said up front that you wanted to tie up some of the loose threads throughout Enterprise, and there are a number of them, but of course the Romulan War is probably, I think, the biggest one that everyone wanted to see. So you decided to write this story. How did you approach it from kind of that deep fandom and universe perspective?
Well, you know, it kind of goes back to what I said earlier about I hadn't been as deep into Star Trek as I am now. I mean, I'd always been a big fan, but doing this is when I really started to get deep into it. So when I first started this project, even I didn't realize how important the Romulan War was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I knew that they were going this direction with the show, and I knew that there was still this unresolved question of the future guy, which I wanted to tackle as well, which is part of the film. And once I kind of settled on some storylines and ideas of what I wanted to do, I decided to start researching the Romulan War more. And I was like, oh, wow, this is like a huge part of canon. I can't believe I didn't know this. And so, I went back and I was watching, you know, rewatching some of the original series episodes. So I did actually do my research for anybody out there who's worried. And it's a good thing, too, because some of the ideas I had to go back and rework when I was first writing the story and the script and to make sure it fit the canon. But, you know, because my first notion, as we talked about, was to write an Enterprise story. That's where I started from, and then I had to work all this huge canon into it. And luckily, as what I'm told is good writing practice, I was outlining before doing the script, so it wasn't a huge deal to go back and rework all that. So for anybody out there who's worried, it does, you know, it's the war is definitely the focus, and but like Mark said, it's not something where you have to know the history. That was very important to me as well.
Right. Yeah, that was a fine line for Enterprise to walk as a series as well. So Mark, the episode that Tommy was quoting earlier about having to go out and fix the mine is the episode Minefield, where we do encounter Romulans in the first season of Enterprise, but according to canon, and when you get to the original series episode Balance of Terror, where Kirk has sort of, you know, the submarine episode with Mark Leonard as the Romulan commander, no one had seen Romulans before and didn't know that they were an offshoot of the Vulcans. So how does Enterprise handle that? And it was that we never actually got to see the Vulcans. And we actually talked about this on the network some years ago. And I think we called the episode of protecting that view screen moment. You had to make sure that you didn't violate canon. So I guess you had to do a lot of research there, Tommy, right?
Yeah, that was the biggest rule that I didn't realize I couldn't break when I was doing the outline. And the number one question I've gotten so far is because one of the characters, main characters in the movie, is a Romulan defector. And everybody asks me, well, how can you have a Romulan defector if nobody's seen a Romulan before? And that's the first thing I thought of. And I was like, oh, shoot, what am I going to do? And then I thought, you know, the answer I came up with really fit the character well. And what she and everybody else is going through is that she was part of this Tal Shiar program to receive modifications, genetic modifications, to essentially become human and infiltrate Starfleet. And the great thing about that is it just makes her so much more untrustworthy. Because not only, you know, is she a Romulan, but how do you even know she's a Romulan? Other than what people are saying, or, you know, maybe this is all part of her plan. And that answer not only fits the canon issue so well, but it fit so well with the story that I wanted to tell of the issues that she's going through of trying to assimilate into this situation, as well as the issues that other people are going through of, do we trust this person or not?
And it makes you wonder if maybe that boss you have at work, who's kind of a taskmaster and untrustworthy, might be a Romulan as well.
That's true. Right? He's, you know, funny story about the boss at work. This is almost related. I always thought a great little tidbit. In fact, something if I'd lost my mind, I would have put this as the closing, like after credits scene, like in a Marvel movie. The main Romulan villain finds himself back on Earth, like, you know, 2000s BC, and finds himself completely lost, but he still has his technology. So what does he do? He builds an empire on Earth and tries to rule it and calls it the Roman Empire. I always thought that would just be a little neat tidbit, but, you know,
yeah,
it's hard to do that kind of thing without really jumping the shark.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Well, let's talk about the casting a little bit. So, Mark, like you said, you're playing the first officer, Jackson Gates, and Tommy, how did you cast everyone in the film here? How did you choose the roles? How did you choose the actors? And who else is going to be in the film?
Well, part of it was a casting call, and part of it was pre-casting. The captain, I had actually met on the webisode that Mark talked about, that Mark wrote and directed, and I was working on with him. And Paul Lang, who's playing the captain, came in and did that, and I thought, wow, this guy is really good. And that was a comedy, too. But it was the kind of thing where I saw him, I was like, man, I bet this guy would make a great Starfleet captain. And ever since that, I always kept it in the back of my mind, and this was a little while before I thought of doing this fan film. And then when I started writing the character, I thought, you know, this guy would be perfect for this role. And so I kind of pictured him. And luckily he said yes right away. He was very interested in doing the role. But some of the others I got from a casting call. It happened very luckily. My chief engineer, who wound up not being available to do this interview tonight, he's a huge Trekkie too. I had posted the casting call and he saw it while posting a casting call for a movie he was directing. And it turns out that he had made his own fan films, like 10 years ago. And so I talked to him, and we hit it off right away, you know, best of friends with all this Star Trek lingo. And he did an audition and it was really good. So that was almost, you know, that was quite fortuitous of a find. And some of the others, like Janine Thompson, who's playing the helm officer, I had known her from some previous work, and I thought of her for the role and asked her if she would do it. Same, actually, for the villain, Rocco Gerlanda. Because the great thing about doing so many projects before this is I've gotten to know a lot of great people and a lot of good talent, and I was able to picture those people in these roles when I was writing it, so I kind of knew who I was writing for and what to give them. Mm-hmm. In some of these main roles.
Mark, you worked with Paul before, because you said that's how you guys met on the short that you did. Had you worked with any of the other actors before, and how are you meshing with them?
I had worked with some, and also come to know some through the auditioning process. You know, a lot of the same actors show up to auditions over and over again, especially in a small acting community like Michigan here. Was going to work with Paul on a movie about a year prior to having him work on my webisode, which that movie unfortunately fell through. But I saw his talent then, and I thought, you know, wow, he's amazing. And if I ever get the chance to work with him, I definitely want to. Coincidentally, he auditioned for my webisode, and once he came in, it was like, you know, I'm done looking. I found the person I want for that role. Janine, I had known of her, and I think had run into her in an audition or two, but really didn't come to know more about her until she auditioned for my webisode as well. Once again with her, it was just like, okay, I'm done looking, because I found I found the actress for that role. So it's just sort of kind of, you know of people, you see them here and there, and some you're fortunate to work with, and others not at that time, but maybe at a later time. So, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like you guys have a really great cast put together. And it's interesting how in this the footage that I've seen and in the photos that I've seen and all, everyone looks so at home in those uniforms. And they feel like actual Starfleet officers from the 22nd century. Maybe that's, you know, it being closer to our time and something we can associate more with, but it all really meshes so well. Janine actually reminds me a little bit of Captain Hernandez.
She does, actually. Now, you know, I hadn't thought of that, but now that you mention it, she kind of does.
With those uniforms, how are you guys making those? Because they really look fantastic.
Thank you. I taught myself how to sew, and I've been doing them all myself.
Well, Tommy, you can do everything. It's really amazing.
Oh, thank you. I couldn't do that before this movie, I will tell you. And because the first thing I thought of is, what am I going to do for... Because this is undoubtedly, I think, the hardest era to costume in terms of Starfleet uniforms. Mm-hmm. They're the most complex uniforms they've had.
And even on the shows, they had trouble. Like, you know, you get different color shades on camera even. So
yeah, because that I think one of the ways that happens is once you wash the uniforms enough, the colors start to bleed and fade. They have 13 zippers in them, for crying out loud. And all these different... Some of the pockets have two flipping zippers, you know? And it's like... And when I was looking how to source these uniforms early on, I couldn't find anyone that did them well. One of the biggest things I found were the division stripes on the shoulders, the, you know, the red or blue or teal or command gold. A lot of times those would just be like these huge pieces of fabric that were like wrapped around the shoulder, or they just were poorly constructed. And then you'd often find that, you know, the pockets weren't done right, or the belts that go to the back weren't done right. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to really be putting this much time and effort and energy into this project, I might as well do it the right way. And I didn't really know of any tailors. I mean, there's, of course, local tailors, but that probably would have cost me a fortune.
You know,
to get, especially for something that's so, you know, abstract. It's not the kind of thing that they get a request for every day.
Right.
So, you know, my mom, too, she did help me learn how to sew. And, you know, I just kind of went, you know, went to town on it. The first two uniforms, I don't have those anymore because they weren't worth setting eyes upon. But by the time I got around
those
to the
those were the index in the uniform line, right? Those were your NX-01, NX-02 uniforms.
Yeah. Those were more like the NX-1.
The alpha and the beta from
First
Flight.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Okay.
Yeah. But by the time I got around to the third one, I had to, you know, kind of kick it into high gear, because this was around last October. I originally wanted to start shooting last summer. So this was like last October. So I finally decided, all right, I just got to start making screen uniforms. And the first one I did was Mark's, actually. And it came out pretty good for the most part. You know, any little blemishes or anything like that are things that won't show up on camera. You know, by now I've made 10 of them. And I can practically do these in my sleep for the most part now. But it is the by far one of the biggest time black holes of time in this project. Yeah. These man, they just take forever to make.
Well, they're really impressive, and I mean, I thought they were impressive to start with, and now you're telling me you learned how to sew to make these uniforms.
Well, thank you.
Very impressive. Mark, has Tommy tried to get all of you guys to learn how to sew and make uniforms in case you have a lot of extras coming in?
Absolutely not. I think he would have found himself cashless had he done that, yeah. Or at least first officer list. No, that would be a huge disaster to get me to try to sew. I sewed a button on once, like maybe 10 years ago, for something that I absolutely had to, you know, it was a shirt, whatever, and I realized at that point, that's not something I should ever do. So, no. I'm glad he didn't ask for help on that.
Buttons are really annoying, too. And there are 4 buttons on this uniform, too, I will have you know. It's really frustrating.
Well, one other creative element that's really important for getting fans to buy in to these independent productions are the visual effects, especially with Enterprise, because with that show being in 2001... to 2005, we were pretty spoiled because by that time they could do fantastic visual effects on television. So I know that has to be a huge challenge for you guys. And I've seen the clips that you have right now of the Discovery kind of spiraling towards the planet, and it's really incredible. It's right up there with the effects that I've been seeing with, you know, what Tobias Richter is doing for Alec Peters with Star Trek Axanar. It's, you know, it looks fantastic like that. And I also watched some of the videos. You guys have great videos on your website from early on in production where you're kind of mocking stuff up, you know, and there's like a model of the Discovery that I guess is just it's like a smooth wireframe on there. So you've gone a long way from there to what I'm seeing in these other clips. Who's working on, I'm afraid, Tommy, you're going to tell me it's you and just you, but who's working with you on the visual effects and how is that process, how has that been going?
It is mostly me. There's a couple other guys that are doing a couple of the models for me. Mm-hmm. Alex Clem, who also goes by Night Fever. I don't know if any listeners might know him from various forums like Foundation 3D or Sci-Fi Meshes. He put together the Vulcan ship that was in the Kickstarter video for me, and he's doing 2 other Vulcan ships. I messaged him because I loved his work, and I asked him if he'd put some models together, and he agreed to. And Ryan McClure, who isn't, he doesn't have as much out there, but he's done some stuff. He's doing the Romulan Warbird for me, mm-hmm. thankfully, because, you know, it just takes forever to model these ships. It's a long time, but... and I have Eric Henry, too, who's also working with Alec on Axanar. He's done some concepts for me, and some people may have seen the as-of-yet-undisclosed station thingy that I posted a concept of on the Facebook page. He did that. But otherwise, it's been all me so far. I did the interiors and the Discovery itself, modeled, textured, rendered, and... For, I think, most of it, for the rest of the movie, it's probably going to be mostly me as well on that, unless some other great people decide to jump on board and, you know, want to contribute.
Well, so you are an incredibly talented man, Tommy.
Well, thank you.
And this must be your full-time job then, because I know from doing this network, Trek FM, I mean, this is pretty much full-time for me. I know how much time just this takes, and the stuff you're doing is... The stuff I do is nothing compared to what you're doing in terms of time involvement.
Well, I suppose I could take this moment now, too, to thank my parents, because I started this during my senior year of college. Mm-hmm. And I worked on it pretty much in all my free time then. And since graduating, they've been incredibly supportive of me working on this. And, you know, they don't make me pay rent or go get a quote-unquote real job or anything, and that has been really helpful in, you know, allowing me to spend all day, every day working mm-hmm. on this. That it's, you know, you're right. It is full time. It's literally pretty much, I don't know what I would do if I wasn't doing this. And that's actually not hyperbole. Like, this is mostly what I do.
Well, it's what you love, and and I mean, this is the greatest portfolio piece that you can possibly create.
Oh, yeah.
So this will pay off, you know, down the road.
It's a multi-purpose kind of thing that way. Yeah. You know, it's a passion project. I love what I'm doing. And it also, you know, not only for me, but it's the kind of thing that I hope that the cast and other crew members will get a lot out of, too. Because a Star Trek fan film is something that hopefully a lot of people are going to see. You know, and maybe somebody will see Paul Lang or Mark Bowers and say, hey, I want to work with that guy. Mm-hmm. And, exactly. You know, that's part of my motivation, too, for putting so much energy into this, is I want it to be a good product for them.
Absolutely. And Mark, an acting question related to the visuals. Science fiction, of course, is one of those genres where there's a lot of work that's done in front of green screens for environments. And I know from looking into the creative process for Horizon that a lot of this is being shot before green screens. Had you done much work in that type of environment before? What has that been like for you?
This has really been my first experience with green screens on this scale. I've done some green screen work where it's been maybe a 10-second scene or something like that, just to be able to create a small visual effect. But but this is, you know, it's walls and floors of just green, and you know, maybe you in a chair, and you definitely have to be able to act and react to stimuli that don't exist when you're on set, but that you know will be put in at a later time. So it's challenging, but Tommy's direction definitely makes it so it's not as challenging as it normally would be. So it's been a good experience thus far. I haven't done too much of the green screen yet with Tommy, but there is definitely more to come in the next few weeks of shooting here. So,
yeah, it's interesting because I know, you know, looking into your background that you did training in theater and you've done things with theater as well. And so there you can really react to what is around you, right? And so it's an interesting transition, I guess, going to green screen environment like this.
Yeah, for sure. In theater, on stage work, even some of the improv work I've done, it's all very immediate. You know, you are reacting to what is happening as we are speaking at this moment, you know. So, so to do it in anticipation of what is going to be filled in later is it's just a different perspective. And I don't dislike one versus the other, you know. When I think about it, it's just just different. So I take it as a challenge and I welcome it. So
it's interesting to note too that oftentimes a lot of, you know, Mark, his first shoot on the green screen, he didn't even have any of the other cast there. Yet he had to be reacting to things that they were doing in the scene. And, you know, part of that is because doing this kind of project with so far, such a low budget, hopefully the Kickstarter will help with that. But, you know, we can't always get people together at the same time. And so that is one of the pros of doing green screen is the way the bridge, for instance, is spaced out. You can film each person separately at their station. And, you know, we don't necessarily have to have the tactical officer there on the same day that we have, you know, the science officer. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of times where we're shooting and they're talking to people that aren't even there to deliver lines. And, you know, I would imagine from an acting standpoint that would be kind of strange. It's, you know, if the person is even supposed to be essentially right next to you. And it makes it interesting, too, from an editing and directing standpoint, too, of course, having to make sure that all lines up later. But it's definitely a unique challenge.
Where are you guys shooting? You know, I know the different facilities that some of the other independent productions have set up for their shooting, and And I know from your videos that you've done some location shooting, you know, out in the woods and such. As far as your set, like you're talking about, you can shoot each tactical station separately. What kind of facilities are you guys using for shooting?
It's very high class. It's my basement. And
are you serious?
Yeah, totally.
Wow.
I have one, you know, I have a green screen wall, and my brother helped me rig up an overhead lighting thing, basically, you know, put some metal bars across the ceiling, screwed them up there that I could hang lights off of to light the green screen. And so far, we've all just been shooting against that one wall in my basement. And one of the cool things is that our makeup artist works with a photographer who has a really great studio in Detroit, and he's also a friend of Paul, the captain. And we're going to be doing a couple of big shoots out there. And he has a huge green screen area. It's like 20 feet high and comes out 20 feet onto the floor. And it's not it's not fabric either. It's a hard surface, so you don't have to worry about wrinkles in your screen or anything like that. So that'll be a really cool place that we're going to be shooting in a couple weeks as well.
Well, that's very interesting. I know anyone listening to this might be hearing, okay, they're shooting in Tommy's basement and there's one wall, but go watch the video, everyone. I mean, I'm very surprised to hear this because I had no idea at all.
I am reluctant to admit that because, I'm also reluctant sometimes to show some behind the scenes clips because I'm afraid people will see that and think, oh, it's this guy in a basement and
preconceived notion of what that means, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't blame them because there's a lot of bad things that are shot in basements. But, you know, if you have dedication and you are really willing to put in the prep work and know what you're doing and know how to light it, you can still do some really great stuff.
One other thing while we're talking about creative that I did want to touch on is the music, because the music is critical to any dramatic production. And I listened to the Star Trek Horizon Overture, which is very beautiful. In fact, I'd like to play a little clip of it right now. And of course, Tommy, it says on there, by Tommy Kraft. So are you composing all of this on the computer? Are you scoring it and you're having an orchestra record it? How are you putting this together? I'm actually a musician, by the way. I played professionally for 7 years, so I'm very well acquainted with the orchestra. And so I was really impressed with
what I
was hearing.
What do you play, by the way?
I play bass trombone.
Oh, cool. I'll have to put in a bass trombone solo somewhere in the score. It's been all computer so far. Using you know, sample sets like East West, Quantum Leaps, Symphonic Orchestra, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It would be really cool to have a live orchestra record this, of course. But I mean, then you're talking mega bucks. Because you have to pay for the orchestra and the recording space and recording engineers. And, I mean, to do it properly the way it needs to be done, it's really outside of the scale of even what we're doing with a Kickstarter budget. But, you know, that said, you can do a lot of really, really good stuff with, you know, if you put the time in, again, with the MIDI and the sample packs, you can do a lot of really high quality stuff. And, you know, I've had a lot of composers actually contact me. I don't even know how many. It's been a lot. And I even had one, you know, because I thought, well, maybe I should have someone else score it. I don't know. But I had him do, you know, like a temp track for a scene. And I was, you know, my degree is in music. And kind of since starting this project, it's been like one of the parts I've really been looking forward to. You know, I'm always a writer director at heart, but I'm also a musician at heart. And so, you know, maybe it seems narcissistic of me, I don't know, but I've come to the conclusion that I'll be the one scoring it for sure. And it's, you know, I love writing music. I think it's a very important part of the process, obviously.
Yeah. And I can tell that really comes through when you listen to the overture here.
That's good. Thank you.
Well, real quick, before we get off of creative, who else is working with you? You mentioned your makeup artist earlier. Who else is helping you guys out on the production side?
That's about it, actually. We have a couple of people that, you know, kind of rotate in for the sound, you know, onset sound boom operator. Joel Worsham is our main guy. He's done the most of it. But we've also had our makeup artist hold the boom on a couple occasions, and we've had some of the actors hold the boom on a couple occasions. And I think that's one of the things people will find quite interesting about this project is just how incredibly small it is, but how large in scale it's hopefully feeling to the viewer. Because, you know, we've had, you know, that's about all we've ever had on set. I've maybe had one or two other people there just to help move stuff or, you know, make sure I don't fall over something when I'm walking backwards with the camera in my hand kind of deal. So other than that, very small.
Interesting. It's very impressive. It really feels like a much, much bigger operation. Well, let's close out with funding. You guys started a Kickstarter campaign with a very reasonable goal of $10,000, which you blew right past. I see right now as we're recording this, you've got 189 backers and you're up around $13,500 and you've got 22 days to go. Of course, your goal of $10,000 is extraordinarily modest for a production like this. So you must have some very serious stretch goals here. If people listening to this want to contribute and want to help you get this film made, and I certainly hope they do, and I know they will if they go to your website and see what you're doing, tell me a little bit more about the Kickstarter and what you're trying to achieve through there.
Well, when I was first setting it up, and just putting a little plug here to Mark, he's the one that he was kind of like the, it was kind of his brainchild, a lot of it. He set a lot of that up for me, and then we got together and went through it and finished the process. But he's been very instrumental in helping me get that kind of stuff off the ground. But when I first started, I talked to Alec from Axnar to get his advice, and he said, you know, I thought I toyed around with the idea of maybe $15,000 for the goal, maybe $30,000. But, you know, he really convinced me that what is the bare minimum that you could do with? And considering what I've done so far, you know, I thought $10,000 is probably the bare minimum that I'd need to finish the movie and get it done. But that being said, you know, if we make the stretch goals, it would be incredibly, incredibly helpful. I just posted the other day, and I'll post the completed picture of it, but my brother has been building a platform that actors can go up on, stand in front of where the warp core will be, like the one that Trip had in engineering. And that was almost, just for the steel, that was almost $200 to build that thing. And you wouldn't think about that when you look at a platform like that. It basically just looks like some metal rods with like a piece of wood or something on it. But, you know, that kind of stuff adds up quick. The chair, you know, for the metal to build that was like $200. And there's so many other things like that that I would like to build and do to get the kind of shots that I want that aren't necessarily required, that aren't part of that quote unquote bare minimum. But if we can do them, it will make it that much better. you know, one of the things I really want to purchase software-wise is TerraGen 3 to really accommodate the alien landscape that we need. And, you know, doing that kind of thing custom in-house always looks so much better than going and buying a piece of stock footage.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, which, by the way, is a very expensive endeavor in its own right.
Right, that's not cheap either.
Yeah. And that could actually turn out to be more expensive in some cases. And then, you know, of course, some of these things are things that I talked about, too, on the Kickstarter video, but computer power is a huge issue because, you know, some of these shots to render them, it's insane how long it takes. And I was working with a scene earlier doing effects for it, and, man, I just frickin' clicking a button in the program would sometimes lock the computer up for 10 minutes because, you know, I have these models that are so highly detailed and textures that are so highly detailed as well, which may not be a problem when you have one ship in your scene. But then when you start loading it down with, you know, 5, 10 or more ships, plus everything else that's going on in the scene, like weapons fire and such, that'll really, really, really bog down your computer. And so the whole thing with the $10,000 goal is that what can I do to at least get this finished in a good way? You know, so with a $10,000 goal, I maybe can't upgrade the computing facilities the way I would like to so I can get it out by the end of the year. It would, you know, it might take longer to because I'm just, the computer is just too slow. I can't purchase or build as much of the camera equipment I need. One of the things I'd really like to get is a motion control rig for the camera. And these have come down a lot in price over the years, but they're still very expensive for a good one. And for those who don't know, it essentially allows you to set up a shot with your camera moving, and it moves the camera with a motor and records that exact motion, and you can repeat it as many times as you want to. And this allows you to essentially film the same shot a bunch of different times with different elements. And this is the main way they do things in movies, where you see people, where the camera will be moving and a person will be disappearing and another person will be reappearing. You know, a good example is X-Men 2, the Nightcrawler scene in the beginning when he's jumping around the White House, disappearing and reappearing. That's all motion control stuff, where the camera is on this exacting rig that moves the camera via computer. So, you know, stuff like that is stuff that isn't technically necessary to finish the production, but it's something that would make it even better. And that's primarily where our stretch goals are going. Also, another thing, this isn't an announcement, but it's something I would like to do, is I would like to try and find a way to get Scott Bakula and maybe Connor Trinneer involved. And, you know, yeah, it would be. And it's not anything that would be a huge role, but it's the kind of thing that would really help add that authenticity. And money talks, you know, and even not to say these people are greedy, but I don't expect them to fly out to Detroit and for a day and shoot these scenes on their own dime, you know, and that's the kind of thing that on $10,000, maybe if I spend half of that, I could get Scott Bakula for a day, maybe, but then there goes half of my Kickstarter budget. So, you know, it's just stuff like that that isn't technically part of the bare minimum, but I would really like to do. Sorry for the really long answer, by the way.
No, that's great. Yeah, people need to know what all this goes towards, because it's, I mean, people know that TV shows and films cost a huge amount of money to make. But of course, for the average person, a number like 10,000, I mean, that's a lot of money right there.
Well,
even though it's nothing when it comes to production.
Yeah, and the thing is that once you're doing a movie with a studio, like studio scale, a lot of your cost goes into things like catering, insurance, and, you know, paying all these people that are involved. And that is one of the benefits of doing almost everything myself, is that I'm not paying an entire production crew, and I can, you know, I can get a lot done for a lot less. way Paul told it once is that he's been on productions where their catering budget was higher than what we've spent so far in this movie for one day.
I bet. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's stuff like that. It's just really, it's really time consuming, but it's about the only way to do it if you don't want to spend millions and millions of dollars.
Well, what kind of rewards can people get when they come and they pledge to the project?
Well, one of the, and in fact, I'm surprised that these haven't all sold by now, but one of the big ones is a custom Starfleet jumpsuit in, you know, your own dimensions, your own measurements. Mm-hmm. And there's, of course, a custom Admiral's jacket. And there's other stuff, too, you know, for obviously much less money. You can get the Blu-ray or the DVD. You can get the NX-04 Discovery patch that I designed. And, you know, if we meet stretch goals, you can get, we'll be sending out Admiral-level rank insignia to all of our donors above $10. And, you know, there's also the Romulan patch that will be included for a higher stretch goal and a poster. And there's a soundtrack CD for one of the pledge levels, stuff like that. You know, it's, some of it's the basic stuff. Some of it's, you know, cool stuff like uniforms that we haven't seen other people do. Mm-hmm. But there, I think there's something there for everybody. There's also credits involved, too, on the film and on our website that you can partake of.
Well, if you're an Enterprise fan and you go to conventions and you want to wear an Enterprise uniform, go pledge and get this custom-tailored Starfleet jumpsuit handmade by Tommy. There's three of them, I believe, right? That you have for the backers. You'll be exclusive at the convention.
That's true. I don't know. I think Anavos is maybe planning on doing some jumpsuits eventually, but I haven't mm-hmm. seen anything. I've only heard rumors about this for like the past year or two.
Yeah,
but I don't know. I mean, this is why I did them, because I don't know of anybody else that actually makes them authentically, you know.
Well, Mark, we've left you out of the discussion here for
that.
A little while as we went over the Kickstarter stuff and all. But of course, it's key to getting the project there. Do you have any final comments about the project? Anything you want to tell Enterprise fans, Star Trek fans, and anything else about Horizon?
I just think it's an amazing project. I'm really honored and thrilled to be a part of it, truly. It's going to be great. It's going to be, yeah, I just think it's going to be, as we've said, something for everyone. I'm very excited to see the final product and to be part of it. And I can't wait for people to see it, really. I want to speed through this whole, you know, Kickstarter and the production and get it out there and be able to kick back and watch it and then to get people's reactions. I think it's going to be really interesting to see. So.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it either. So Tommy, last thing here, if people want to find out more, if they want to watch those videos that I've mentioned a few times during the discussion today, if they want to, you know, see some of the artwork, find out more about the premise, and of course support the Kickstarter and follow you guys on social media as well, where should they go?
Well, we have our official website, and that's StarTrekHorizon.com, and we have our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/STHorizon, and those are about the two main places. I have a personal Twitter. I don't tweet very often. But those are about the two main places to keep up. The Facebook usually gets the information first, and then it all gets, you know, backlogged onto the website.
Excellent. Well, I hope everyone will check it out. I'm really excited about it as an Enterprise fan. Anytime that we can build upon that story, which was so sadly cut short, thanks to the, you know, the realities of television. That's wonderful. And I really appreciate you guys taking some time with me this week to come on the show and tell everyone about this.
No problem. Glad to be here. It's very fun. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, there you have the story of Horizon and what I think is really an incredible story of creativity and what is now possible to create on a micro budget with today's technology. And a moment ago, we talked a bit about the Kickstarter, but one thing we did not mention is that this Sunday, May 4th, tomorrow, in fact, if you're listening to this episode right after it drops, Tommy will be releasing the first 5 minutes of the film for those who support the Kickstarter campaign. Now, I've seen it, and it's really intriguing, and it's beautifully done, and it really gets you excited to find out where the story is going. So don't miss that. And again, as Tommy mentioned, you can find out more about Horizon on their website at StarTrekHorizon.com. And from there, you can get to the Kickstarter, the Facebook page, and more. Well, it's been great learning about Horizon today, and I really appreciate Tommy and Mark spending some time with me. But this is only one of the Trek topics we've been talking about on the network this week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Dr. McCoy with Larry Nemechek.
But, you know, when everybody else had their Kirk shirt or their Spock shirt, like the first uniform I had my mom make me was a McCoy uniform, of course.
Earl Grey.
The 7-7 Challenge.
Did you know that Tim Russ was one of the possible choices for Commander Jordy LaForge?
But did you know he was also in Star Trek Generations?
But did you know he was also served with Captain Sulu on board the Excelsior?
I did know that, in fact. The Orb.
Our Man Bashir Commentary.
I love Avery. Tell me what happens next.
And the look up at an angle. He's not even looking at Bashir, he's looking up at the angle. Tell me what happens next.
The Ready Room.
Spectre of the Gun.
They're so quick to jump to conclusions, like the guy gets shot in front of them and they're like, death is the only thing that's real on this planet. You're like, wait a minute, how do you know that? That could just be a total figment of your imagination as well.
To the journey!
Favorite Sun commentary.
Yeah, Janeway is... you better get more coffee, sweetie. It's going to be a long day. Ensign Kim is going to put you through some hell.
Warp 5.
Alternate outcomes of the Zindi crisis.
But the Enterprise is heavily damaged. We're talking... practically destroyed. Everything but a shell. Maybe the saucer section is the only thing that's still around. And 80% of the crew dies.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Rick Berman and Star Trek.
It's kind of a moving target. So he found some dimensionality. He made it into a cube.
Yeah.
And so he was able to move things around in there.
A Borg cube.
Continuing mission.
Star Trek Equinox.
John Savage actually came up with the premise for the story, but they needed somebody to flesh it out, to develop it. And so they sent me John's premise, and I just, well, it expanded into the script for the project that we're doing.
Melodic Treks.
The Borg in Music.
In when they released it as a Blu-ray,
they combined them.
They connected them, and there's the no feature. Delay. They cut off that music, and then it's just like, oh, that didn't work.
Literary Treks.
Rise of the Federation, Tower of Babel.
Saval talks about this idea that, you know, people mutually consent to abide by these rules for their collective benefit. The idea that, you know, absolute unfettered freedom is just a ridiculous idea.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. We're now on Spreaker as well, and also on BlackBerry. And of course, you can stream or you can get the RSS feed right there from our website. And going back to iTunes, if you're over there, be sure to visit our new home in the iTunes store, where you'll find our dedicated artist page and section where we're now able to group and highlight our shows and episodes to help you find past content that you may not have heard. We're quickly approaching 1,000 episodes here on Trek FM, which is hard for me to believe, but we do have shows covering every single series, as well as, you know, specialty topics such as music and science. And of course, news and general discussion as well. So we've got a lot of discussion and interviews waiting for you there. And our new page in iTunes will help you find those and see what you've missed in the past. And the best way for you to get there, the quickest way, is just to go to itunes.com/trekfm. And that'll open things right up there in your iTunes application. Also, if you enjoy the show, please take a moment to leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to hear from you, and it does help other Star Trek fans find the show as they're looking through the iTunes store. Before I let you go, I'd also like to tell you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. Audible is the best source for audiobooks you'll find online. They have more than 150,000 titles for you to choose from right now, and they add hundreds of new titles every single week. New releases, classics, bestsellers. They've got a lot of Star Trek books, science, pretty much any genre you can think of. Lots of great stuff there for you, especially with great narrators as well. If you love podcasts, you're going to love audiobooks. It's a wonderful way to read, and it gives you a chance to read all those books that you've always wanted to read, but you never thought you'd have time for. And as a Trek FM listener, we do have a special offer for you. You can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. And the way you do that is to go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up. Choose whatever book you like, and if at the end of the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you get to keep that free book. But as I said, if you like podcasts, you're going to love audiobooks. And if you're already getting them from another source, give Audible a try. They have great prices, great selection. It's where I've been getting my books for 14 years now. No plans to stop anytime soon. And I really, really do appreciate their support of Continuing Mission and the network. So get your free trial, get your free audiobook at audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thanks for listening this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, and join me again next time on this Continuing Mission, and let's see what's out there.